I'm Alexis Petridis, and welcome to Music Weekly from The Guardian. Coming up, we speak to Victoria Legrand from Beach House about the new album Teen Dream and her feelings on the scene that people are calling chillwave.
I just think it's another innocent title. You know, genres are harmless things. They don't really mean anything anymore.
Steve Mason, Yeasayer and Licky Lee feature in Singles Club. And we'll be talking to Paul Rose about the rise of dubstep and his label Hot Flush in our feature Your Label Show.
The label originally was intended as a platform for music that wouldn't otherwise have been heard, really.
That's all in Music Weekly. I am happy, as ever, to be joined by Rosie Swash. How you doing, Rosie?
I'm very good. How are you?
I'm not too bad. What have you been up to?
What have I been up to? Oh, God, now I need to think of something culturally relevant.
Not fast enough. Anyway, and today we're also joined by Sam Richards, freelance writer extraordinaire, known for his contributions to The Guardian Guide and other publications. How are you doing, Sam?
I'm very well, thanks, Alex.
Have you got any interesting anecdotes about what you've been up to recently?
Well, I'm putting together a festival's guide for The Guardian Guide at the moment.
So It's that time of year.
So I'm immersed in what's happening.
What festival is looking good at the moment? Don't say Glastonbury. What festival other than Glastonbury is looking good this
year? Well, I'm always a big fan of Bestival, and they seem to put together a pretty interesting lineup.
Is Brian Ferry playing at Bestival?
Brian Ferry Festival. They're reforming Roxy Music to play.
Roxy Music are playing at Bestival. Wow, that sounds fantastic. Who else?
With Eno.
I beg your pardon, sorry.
Sorry, that was me trying to say with Eno or without.
I don't think Eno is involved. No, I think that might...
Eno's doing the Brighton Festival. Eno is curating the Brighton Festival and is moving to Brighton for its duration. Isn't that exciting?
Can pop round for a cup of tea?
I don't think he knows that guy, kind of pop round for a cup of tea guy. But, I mean, you know, if he wants to pop round, he's more than welcome. Who else is on at Bestival?
Well, I think I saw the Fall were playing, which is...
could go either way.
Always an entertaining time.
Fever Ray?
Oh, yes, Fever Ray. Yes, she's doing her only festival appearance, I think that's...
That'll be interesting if it's on during the daytime. Because I don't see... Have you ever seen Fever Ray live?
I didn't catch a live show, but I saw her interesting performance at the Grammys, the Swedish Grammys on YouTube.
Yeah, I mean, it's all very reliant on it being sort of dark. I mean, you can't really see the band on stage. It's sort of a sort of curtain of dry ice and darkness with these eerie figures looming out of it, which will be sort of amazing if it's 2:30 in the afternoon and quite windy and all the dry ice gets blown away and basically it's just a load of Swedish blokes with masks on.
And I think the good thing about Bestival is that they tend to get the programming within the festival right, so they have the right bands on at the right time, so you don't end up seeing sort of madness at 1 a.m. when you really want some kind of hardcore raving music.
Yeah, absolutely. Now that sounds great. That sounds really good. Well, look, thank you very much for coming in, Sam. First up today, it's Beach House. The American duo are known to their mums and dads as Victoria Legrand and Alex Scally. Sounds a bit scary. Their new album, Teen Dream, was produced and engineered by Chris Cody, who worked on the Yeah Yeah Yeahs album and on TV on the Radio's records as well. They've been placed in genres including chillwave and dream pop. And Rosie, you spoke to Victoria about how they feel regarding those labels.
Obviously, we're here to talk about Teen Dream. My first question relates to the way the album has been received, because I've been a fan of your band's since the first album, and I was quite taken aback by the excitement that greeted this record, because I kind of didn't think that you guys were that big. Do you know what I mean? And then suddenly it seemed like everybody was talking about it, and it was the record that everyone was waiting for. Why do you think that it received that kind of attention?
I don't really know. This is our third record, and you know, we've been working hard and steadily and touring a ton, for 4 years. So who can say really why it's going to get a lot of attention? I just think that for us, it's a very exciting time because we worked extremely hard on this record, and you know, we spent 8 to 9 months writing it, and then a month in the studio. It's been definitely, you know, a labor of love. It leaked in November, so sometimes leaks can kind of contribute to that, maybe excitement or hype or things like that, because it's free. And, you know, the internet especially adds a lot of energy and excitement as well, because things can spread freely. But I really hope that in the end, it's ultimately because of the music. Working with Chris, he's worked with TV on the Radio and Yeah Yeah Yeahs and things like that. And he's a very accomplished person and very good at what he does. But with Chris understood that we have a very clear sense of how we want to sound, and we've always had that from the start. I think that he was really good at getting us to do takes. You know, he got really great live takes out of us. It's not Chris Cody, the producer, stamping Beach House with his sound. It's Beach House having an idea of a sound and finally being able to get that sound, because we're surrounded pretty much by these instruments that we love very much. They're not expensive. It's not expensive gear or fancy vintage gear necessarily. It's just the junk, the keyboards, the organs that we've collected over the years.
Could you tell me what you called it junk there? What some of the what your primary junk is to make that very distinctive Beach House sound?
The instruments that we use on Teen Dream are the same instruments we've been using since the beginning. You know, Alex's guitar and my, you know, Yamaha white keyboard. They are family organs, probably from the 70s, you know, that are not very valuable. But for us, it's valuable in the sense of what it was given to us, which is sort of priceless. Don't forget the nights when it all fell right. Are you not the same? I am aware that this is a name slash genre that exists now for bands like Neon Indian and Washed Out and a bunch of other things. I just think it's another innocent title. You know, genres are harmless things. They don't really mean anything anymore, really. You know, like weird dream pop, that doesn't bother us. They're just words that people need to describe things, and there's nothing wrong with that. But chillwave to me is just another name of something, and there are so many different kinds of music.
Do you think it's relatively technical, or it just sums up?
I think it just describes like people chill out to the music. Okay. I don't even think it's like deep. I just think that someone just went chillwave. Makes them want to like.
What you mean? There's no real theory behind
weed
it.
And like, you know, it's like it's harmless. Alex and I have been working on it for a long time, and you know, a lot of these bands that are in chillwave are bands that just started like a year ago.
Yeah.
So I mean, I do think that in some way it's something that we've been working on for a while. You know, we're never offended by, you know, like we had an article in NME, Leaders of the Pack or something, about, you know, kind of putting us in with a bunch of other bands, and I think it's just like fine, people do that. You know, like I said, people need guides to uncovering music.
My final question to you is, what was your teen dream?
Being a teenager is kind of rough, because I was pretty much, I was neither popular nor a loner. I was kind of in the middle. I worked really hard as a teenager, I remember that. I was actually a pretty good student. My most teenage moment, I think I probably just wanted to be in love with somebody, you know, and have somebody write me letters.
So you were a wistful teenage girl.
I think most teenage girls are, at heart, teenagers are fun, irrational, passionate, impulsive creatures. So it's a very powerful energy that I hope that we can all tap into even as we get older.
That's Victoria Legrand from Beach House talking about their new album, Teen Dream, and about Chillwave, the genre name with which they have been labelled. Now, I am obviously of enormously advanced years. I'm 38 and I'll be dead soon. To me, Chillwave strikes me as being basically what we used to call back in the 1800s shoegazing, given a different and difficult though it is to imagine worse name than shoegazing. Sam, would you, is that right? I mean, how do you differentiate a chillwave band from one of the bands of my youth, such as Slowdive?
Well, I think most of the chillwave stuff seems to be done by individuals or people working in their bedrooms. Mm-hmm. And it has that sort of faint electronic, sort of using lo-fi electronic tinge to it. Mm-hmm. And people have been able to make it very easily. And because lo-fi is part of the whole aesthetic behind chillwave, that means it's been kind of easy for people to make and put up on the internet and propagate via MP3 blogs pretty quickly, to the point where if you look at some popular MP3 blogs at the moment, or even sort of Pitchfork's new music blog, every other track is a chill wave track.
Really?
Yeah, there's a huge amount of it around sort of suddenly, within the last few months. And I think that's because it appeals to a very particular audience, possibly the audience that write and read music blogs, as well as it being kind of easy to make. But a lot of the music is kind of pleasant and nice.
What a enormously enticing recommendation that is. Now, Rosie, what do you make of this? Are you a sort of fan of other chillwave? Let's define, who are some other chillwave artists other than Beach House?
The thing here is, are Beach House chillwave or not? And they would say they're
That's
not.
What everyone's
That's
asking.
That's what everyone's talking about. We had to have it on the show sooner or later. I don't think they are, simply because they've been around for such a long time that you can't possibly say that they're part of a scene that is, less than a year old. But they also, I think, preceded a lot of the elements that you find in chillwave, which is the incredibly nostalgic sound of the music. And this, so much so in Teen Dream, which is, completely nostalgic in its themes as well. The name Beach House, a lot of these bands have names that are reference, the pastoral and the scenic, and they're not about being in the city. And they also, all their songs will literally talk about getting stoned on the beach or something like that. Like, it's so far removed from anything urban or anything, another criticism that's been levied at it is that it's kind of apolitical, that it's so easy to make this kind of music, which is totally about escapism, because you actually have to talk about anything. And if it's totally nostalgic, then you're already playing on the sentimentality.
That's also an accusation that was levelled at shoegazing at the time, was that it was, sort of apolitical and, incredibly middle class. And it has to be said, it did see the sound of a shoegazing band seemed to affect middle class youths from the sort of Thames Valley area in the same way that the skirl of the pipes affects a Scotsman. You know, so you just sort of draw them in.
I don't think that's necessarily... That's necessarily an entirely bad thing.
No, though. No.
And I was kind of thinking about this morning. Obviously, shoegazing was a term that was levelled at that scene initially as a pejorative.
Absolutely, yeah.
But if you then have a look at sort of the bands that were being championed by the people who were against shoegazing at the same time, maybe these sort of more raw, in-your-face bands with a political message, I don't know, like... You'll remember better, Credit to the Nation.
Credit to the Nation, absolutely. Chumbawamba,
things like that.
The Levellers. So, it was Slim Pickens at that point.
So we're laughing now, but we're laughing at those bands, but things like My Bloody Valentine and even Ride and Slowdive are now sort of still loved and loved by a new generation of people, obviously, the chillwave people.
I mean, that's sort of amazing for me to see. Are they sort of an influence? Are these bands an influence on chillwave?
Absolutely.
You said My Bloody Valentine, without doubt. Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, it's more so than anyone musically, whether it's an obvious influence or not, a lot of them sound like Slowdive to me, particularly when Slowdive started to go electronic.
Yeah. Quite underrated band, Slowdive, I think.
So.
I think with the benefit of hindsight, I've gone back to some of that music recently, just sort of wallowing in my... in nostalgia for my misspent youth. And actually, a surprising amount of it stands up quite well, considering how sort of reviled it was at the time and how it all ended fairly dramatically because people decided it wasn't very good. So that's sort of interesting. So are Beach House kind of the progenitors of chillwave? Are they the My Bloody Valentine? Are they to chillwave what My Bloody Valentine were to shoegazing?
It's tricky to... But chillwave, the term, was made up by Carlos from... the Hipster Runoff blog, and he used it to describe some of the people that we've had on the show before, like Nigel, we had her on, her kind of music, and people we haven't had on, like Memory Tapes and Neon Indian. And his definition of it was literally, sounds like something playing in the background of an old VHS cassette that you found in your attic from the late 80s/90s.
That's interesting. That sounds to me more like some Aerial Pink or somebody like that. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, I think he'll be... in fact, Hipster Runoff were talking about Aerial Pink and Chillwave just this week.
They've been talking about it a lot.
His new record that's out on 4AD certainly has much Chillwave elements to it.
Okay, fantastic. I wonder how long it'll be before people go, you know, oh, we're not really Chillwave. You know, Chillwave also becomes a sort of pejorative term.
All bands say that no bands like to be within a genre, but it does make things easier for us and the listener, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. Well, look, Teen Dream was released on Sub Pop in January. If you feel like Chillwave is something you should investigate, why don't you go out and get yourselves a copy? Time for Singles Club now, the place where we discuss the new releases that we're keen on this week. Let's start with Rosie's Choice. I'm a lost and found at the base of the river. I'm a lost and found. I'm a lost and found. I'm a lost and found at the base of the river. I'm a lost and found at the base of the river. That was Lost and Found by Steve Mason, formerly of the Beat Band. I actually nearly brought that in myself.
Really? Yeah, that's a good sign.
That's your choice. Tell us what you like about it.
Well, it's no... Anyone that's listened to this pod for a long time will know that I absolutely love the Beat Band. Mm-hmm. And I also love Steve Mason's various solo guises.
King Biscuit Time,
I liked a lot. Black Affair was the last one, and he put that album out amid... you know, a problematic time in his psyche.
Has there ever been a non-problematic time in his psyche? I met him once and he was absolutely ghastly.
Really? Because I got on with him quite well.
Oh, he hated me.
And I think it was, I can't remember exact sequence of events, but he sort of put out a cancellation notice or something.
Yeah.
Prior to, you know, at one point, no, none of this music was right, let me start again. Black Affair was a bit more Italo disco, very nice. Mm-hmm. But this to me is the most like anything he's done with the Beat Band for quite a while. He won't like that because he absolutely hates everything that he did with the Beat Band.
Yeah, he didn't appear like anything when I met him, Beat Band related or otherwise, to be honest with you.
They had some financial issues with a tax man. Mm-hmm. About a year and a half ago, he was telling me that... you know, some sort of accountant somewhere had mucked up, and the result was that all the members of the Beat Band had a kind of tax bill that they couldn't pay.
Wow.
And I said, why don't you reform the Beat Band? And you can put, you know, even though you only split up about 3 or 4 years ago, everyone will love it because I love you. And he was like, I'll never do that. He doesn't want to revisit something that he's done. And also, I guess if you're not particularly happy in a period of time, that music that you create then isn't gonna thrill you to perform that again. But despite all that, I do think that, you know, every time I hear his voice when he's been away for a while, I just think, oh, it's just so lovely. It's like I've been waiting to hear it for ages. And there's nothing particularly new or groundbreaking about this song, but I just think it's kind of, you know, classic Steve Mason.
Yeah.
And he just does it so well, and his voice just absolutely shines.
It's a good sound. Sam, what did you think of it?
I have to admit, I wasn't so much of a fan. And I am a big fan of the Beat Band stuff. And... you know, you can always go back to listen to that, and it sounds pretty interesting. And so what I think the Beat Band had, which this song doesn't seem to have, is the way that they constructed rhythms, and they used a lot of percussion. And the loop on this song just sounds really tired and dated, and it seems to kind of drag the whole thing down. Mm. I think Steve Mason's voice is always interesting, that kind of deadpan tone that he has to it, which is sort of the opposite of what you're meant to do when you're singing, which is sort of over-express.
Yeah, emote. Yes, absolutely.
He seems to do it the other way, which I always think is interesting. But the rest of it did sound a bit dreary to me.
Didn't really grab you. I think it's interesting that he's so sort of averse to the Beat Band back catalogue. One of the things I was thinking about this the other day is there was a brief period in about 1998 when the Beta Band had reasonable claim to be called like the most influential band in sort of British rock, because Oasis, you know, said they were going to make an album that sounds like the Beta Band, which turned out to be Standing on the Shoulder of Giants. And, you know, Radiohead appeared to be under the sway. There were an inordinate amount of press. They were a huge band. And they just appeared to completely fritter away every bit of goodwill that they had. They appeared to make sort of really, you know, crushing categoric mistakes in terms of putting out a debut album that was a bit patchy, and there were better songs on the singles, and they didn't really pick... and never really got it back again. I often wonder what it must be like to hold that thing in your hands. Although he didn't appear to be enjoying that either, being in a hugely influential position. and just to sort of, you know what I mean, to see it scatter, to see it sort of vanish, and to have been sort of, I don't know.
Was it Heroes to Zeros they put out an official apology for? Which I actually really like.
God, no, it was their first album after the three EPs. I don't know.
It's just called the Beta Band,
right?
Isn't it?
Okay, and they did later apologise.
Yeah. Which is to stop apologising. People actually like it.
Yeah. I mean, I actually think that's quite an underrated album, the first Beta Band album. But there you go. Anyway, he's back, as they say in Smash Hits. His new album, which is out on Domino in May, is produced by Richard X. Interesting choice of producer. Lost and Found will be on the album, which is called Boys Outside, and it's actually out on May the 3rd. Now it's Sam's turn. That was Yesaya, O-N-E, or One, single taken from their album Odd Blood. Sam, you brought that in.
Well, I just think it's fascinating that what by many people's opinion seems to be their favourite pop record of the year so far, including several daytime Radio 1 DJs, is made by a band of sort of Brooklyn hippies who were sort of have been dismissed by many people previously as making some kind of silly or affected world music, and they seem to have turned it around and made an amazing pop record.
I completely agree. I went to see them in Brighton a few weeks back, and I confess I hadn't heard Odd Blood before I went. I'd heard their previous album, and I really went on sufferance because I thought, the last thing I want, it was a Friday night, I didn't really want to go out. Last thing I want to see is a lot of kind of Brooklyn, you know, art, wanky, you know what I mean? No tunes wrong. And they came on, it was just one tune after another. They were absolutely magnificent. So much so that I bought the album on the way out. I actually bought the, rather than ringing the press officer up for a copy, I paid for it with my own cash money. And what it reminded me of, brilliant pop tunes, is that sort of brief period in the 80s where there was a lot of kind of, I don't know how you describe it, prog pop in a way, sample heavy records like Peter Gabriel's fourth album, The Dreaming by Kate Bush, The Flat Earth by Thomas Dolby, blank faces of two young people I'm talking to here, no idea, I might as well have been saying, you know, in the war we had powdered egg. Anyway, it's people that were sort of aligning, I think, a distinct pop sensibility with a kind of more avant-garde approach. A lot of uses where the Fairlight synthesizer first sort of come into play. And it really reminded me of that. It seemed to have boundless imagination, but tied to just wicked tunes.
Yeah, exactly, and not afraid to be pop about it, which has always been a problem for bands in the alternative
Americans,
sector.
I think.
Yeah, yes, actually that's true. That's true, you know, and certainly, you know, probably since Sonic Youth and Nirvana time, you know. But Yesaya have none of those pretensions, in fact, that people have thought they might have as sort of an art rock band. And I think, you know, even on their first album, you can, it's all there already.
Yeah.
You know, just the fact that they've got plenty of ideas, that they're not embarrassed about fishing for things in the past that might have previously been considered taboo, and finding new ways that they can reuse them. They're just a really kind of bright, intelligent band. Without any hang-ups, which is rare.
That's good. Rosie, do you like it?
I do like it a lot, and I like Odd Blood. And I think similarly to you, I wasn't waiting for this record. You know, I kind of thought, oh, yeah, give it a listen. And I think part of I think I agree with everything you said about it just being great tunes and really well done. But also what I like about them is the same reason that I never quite liked them before, which is that when they first came out, unfairly for them, I think that single 2080 sounded a little bit Afropop.
Yeah.
They kind of got lumped in with Vampire Weekend. And then the rest of it was a bit, you know, they kind of got lumped in with MGMT and that kind of psychedelic indie pop, neither of which was particularly fair.
It's more folk influence to me, that first album, than anything else.
You know, I mean, a lot of people didn't listen past the first singles, and that album was very, very folky in parts. And I was, you know, thinking about it with Odd Blood is I just don't really get what's at the core of them. I don't know what their underlying thing is. And that's a great thing, actually. Like, sometimes it's a reason why you can't really go for a band. But I think in this case, I think it's great because you never really know what they're going to do next.
I read in, I think it was the New York Times, that their change in direction was, was preempted by taking a load of LSD while in New Zealand. Who knew?
Well, and
you'd have to do something in New Zealand.
Is it really boring?
Notoriously.
Oh, right, okay. Apologies to any listeners in New Zealand for Rosie's racist attack upon your country.
Sorry.
Yes, Sam, sorry, you're going to say, before Rosie started kicking off on the Kiwis.
I think that probably not enough bands take themselves on crazy psychedelic adventures these days. So, why not?
It's interesting that it's made them more pop, I think, rather than, you know, more, I don't know, let's just have a jam session and we'll be free and music has no boundaries. It's a great record. If you haven't heard the album One Blood, I can't, really, really can't recommend it highly enough. Chock full of tunes. Really interesting, great record. Finally, it's my single club selection. It's Licky Lee. That was a remix of Dance, Dance, Dance by Licky Lee, re-edited and remixed by a producer called Dixon. I'm not actually sure if Dixon had permission to do that. I fear the 12-inch that it's out on is actually a bootleg. The other side of it has a version of a great old house track by Romantini called The Wanderer, for any 90s house fans who are listening. I just really, really, really like that record. I think that the original, if you know, which is on Licky Lee's album, is quite insubstantial. It's a little kind of floaty sort of filler track, and he just seems to have put a whopping beat behind it and turned it into total primetime dance floor material. I got it in a package of, I ordered a load of singles from the record shop Fonica week before last, and this was the one that really stood out as the thing that if you heard it in a club at, you know what I mean, 2 o'clock in the morning when your eyeballs are pointing in different directions, you would go right off, as we used to say. I really, really like it. Sam?
Yeah, I think that's great, and I really like all the productions from that stable, from the Univision stable, people like Dixon and AIM, is that how you say it?
Yeah, I don't know if it's got an accent.
AIM or AME.
AME, yeah.
And Henrik Schwartz. And
Henrik Schwartz is wicked, I think.
Yeah, it's sort of, it's sort of deep house, I suppose, in name. There's a real kind of chewiness to their stuff, which, it's just really makes it sound great coming out of a decent sound system.
Absolutely.
Without being pumping.
Yeah, it isn't obviously pumping, I think, which is a good thing.
Groovy. Maybe.
Groovy.
Maybe.
Nothing worse than an obvious pump. Rosie!
I like this a lot. And like you, wasn't really into the original at all. And I think that Licky Lee's album had a lot of weak bits on it, of which this was one. But I love the fact that the beat is so soft. It just makes me want to melt when listening to it. And also, her voice is just so nice. We've talked a lot on this pod recently about kooky female singers. And I think she just doesn't fall into that camp. I think she gets it just right with her vocals. They're unusual, but I don't think that they're affected. Partly could maybe because she's Swedish and they all sound a little bit like that anyway. I think chewy is a great adjective for this record. That's which I didn't think of Sam as a good adjective.
So three thumbs up for Licky Lee. Should we all split a pill and listen to it again? Dance, Dance, Dance from Licky Lee, the Dixon remix, is out now on Philomena. I paid £12 for my copy of that, which is a lot of money.
Is that what vinyl costs these days?
It's absolutely insane. I discovered the other day that the average vinyl sale of a dance single is under 1,000 copies now, which seems absolutely remarkable. I think Floating Point's last single did like 1,500 or 1,700, and that was, people were like, oh my God, how many records of Floating Point sold? So yeah, it was £12. Nice pressing, which is obviously... But I complained about that and then decided it was worth every penny. It's out now on a label called Philomena. Right, we're going to take some of your comments now from the web, from the interweb, and from Twitter regarding last week's show. Jamesy101 said, "This love affair with Kasabian has to stop. They are an atrocious band." Then changing tack, he said, "Tomorrow in a Year is a fantastic album. Casting aside artists that are pushing music to the far-reaching ends of the spectrum is the reason there is so much consistently average music on the mainstream music radio stations. Banal."
Did
we mention Kasabian last week?
We took the piss out of them for saying omelette.
Omelette, yes.
You know,
yes.
We were just.
I think last week was people about the most underground this show's ever been, isn't it? It was all about Rocket from the Tombs and stuff like that. Whatever.
Just not taking it seriously enough at Exit.
Slick Tony said, "Personally, I think the Knife Software is awful. Where the music on their proper album Sparkled is just drones along." RG Scott said, "Olaf could have taken his mask off, though, for the interview, since it was over the phone. Could hardly hear a word." Actually, you did it face-to-face, didn't you?
No, we did it on the phone, which was what... But he insisted that his vocals were distorted.
Wow. So maybe he's a terrorist.
It was actually quite an interesting interview, although he is a very cerebral human being. And then having it on the phone in a Swedish accent, then distorting it was quite... tricky.
It was a little bit tricksy. Yeah. On Facebook, Chris Jones said, "This week's pod was such a laugh that for a moment I thought I was listening to a Ricky Gervais guide to modern music." Starts well. This comment goes rapidly downhill after this. So who was Carl Pilkington? It has to be Alexis with his Northern accent. Talking about Coleman, his head like a fucking orange.
I don't understand.
Are you saying I have a head like a fucking orange? What are you saying, Chris? Explain
Chris
yourself.
Chris Jones isn't usually rude, so I don't think that...
Did I say someone had a head like a fucking orange?
I don't think so.
Who's got a head like a fucking orange? I'll tell you who's got a head like a fucking orange. Claire Sweeney. Maybe, did we mention her at all?
Is that Come Dine With Me? No, what?
Well, Claire Sweeney, you know, she used to be in... what did she used to be in? I don't know, Brookside or something?
Yeah, she was on Come Down.
She looks like a cross between an orange and a hamster. thank you for all your comments on the blog. And don't forget, we've got a Facebook page too. Just search for Music Weekly on Facebook. And it's Music Weekly Pod, all one word, on Twitter. Moving on to your label showing, a feature which highlights a particular imprint that we like. We speak to the founder or people involved with the label and we get you a potted history. Today is the turn of DJ, producer and founder of Hot Flush Recordings, Paul Rose.
My name's Paul Rose. I make music as Scuba and I run a label called Hot Flush. I'm going to be talking a little bit about that. The label originally was intended as a platform for music that wouldn't otherwise have been heard, really. It was first released, came out in 2003. A bunch of us all got on the same pirate radio station at the same time, and everyone was making tracks, and none of us really had a clue about releasing, or, you know, no one had, like, you know, any good kind of, like, industry contacts or whatever. And it was literally just a case of, okay, let's press up some records and get some stuff in the shops and see what happens. But it was a complete DIY thing, and it just kind of gradually built up and got more and more attention and kind of gradually got to where it is now. Been DJing for a long time before we started it, and, you know, there were certain kind of people who had done it in certain ways that I was you know, interested in and wanted to kind of not replicate but kind of maybe emulate, you know. Labels like RNF, Belgian techno label, Hospital Records was really influential for us at the start. Basically labels that had kind of forged a really distinctive sound but done their own thing, you know. The label it was originally intended to be a lot more wide-ranging than it has actually turned out to be. I mean, we didn't start it as a kind of quote-unquote dubstep label or even a dubstep-related thing. It's difficult to kind of pin down without, you know, getting into kind of really kind of, I don't know, pretentious cul-de-sacs. But, I mean, all the music we've had on the label so far has had a kind of similar kind of sound without actually, you know, having too many kind of sonic indicators. So it's pretty hard to pin down. But I suppose, I mean, you know, it's all kind of electronic, vaguely garage-influenced stuff. But we've always kind of sat slightly to the left of the kind of, you know, quote-unquote mainstream of dubstep. So yeah, it's kind of, I guess dubstep is maybe a starting point, and we've always tried to keep kind of one toe in it, you know. Certainly in the last sort of 2-3 years when it's really been kind of branching out quite widely, but we've kind of been conscious to, you know, say, you know, well, this is kind of where we come from, and I don't, you know, I don't like a lot of what has happened with dubstep over the last 2 years, but I think we kind of feel some responsibility to try and keep a toe in it and try and keep trying to, you know, keep it interesting and trying to keep it the kind of, you know, vital thing that it was originally when it first, you know, was kind of developing. The second Scuba album is coming out in March. And also there's three that we're kind of excited about and we're trying to kind of, mould in the right way, if that's the right word. So it's Mount Kimby, who had the first two releases last year, and they're doing an album for us at the moment, which is going to be coming out in May. Joy Orbison, who is probably, people have probably heard of him, due to the single that came out last year. I mean, I don't even think particularly that it's his best tune at all, you know, but it's just, that's just the one that, you know, grabbed people and kind of like got this, you know, huge kind of internet hype thing rolling. And but not to say that, you know, the tune didn't necessarily deserve it, and, you know, and that he doesn't deserve it. No, it's great what's happened. And also Sire, who's doing some really interesting takes on kind of Berlin techno, but in a kind of almost, and it kind of UK takes on that. So yeah, those are the kind of three that we're kind of excited about at the moment.
That was Paul Rose talking about his record label Hot Flush Home, as you heard there, to Joy Orbison, as well as a whole bunch of dubstep and related recordings. Apparently they're sort of focusing on building the links between breaks, electro, and the styles which emerge from the UK garage movement, dubstep and grime. It's a continually sort of thriving and evolving scene. Rosie, are you a fan?
Well, I always was put off by dubstep. Because I thought it was just so incredibly blokey.
Mm.
And, well, I guess it's, you could say that about a lot of dubstep.
Well, it's interesting.
Really,
our producer, Amy, went to a dubstep event at the weekend and said Block. Yeah, the big sort of 3-day festival. And she said it was like 70% blokes there.
Oh, God. 70% bloke festival just sounds awful.
Sounds quite bad, doesn't it?
But what I think is good about this kind of offshoot, this sort of future garage stuff, is that it's, as well as being more interesting and more danceable and kind of more positive sounding, it's a bit more female friendly, isn't it?
Definitely. I mean, I wouldn't have, I love Joy Orbison, and I can't wait for everything that comes out. But I felt very much that was, you know, part of the two-step revival. I wouldn't have really classed that as dubstep at all. But then I think when we had Joe Goddard on the show a couple of weeks back, he talked about the Joker remix of Cruel Intentions, which is like every possible kind of dance music, you know, funky, dubstep, garage, all in one.
The Joker is Purple Wow, isn't he? I think,
there you go.
Isn't that the appellation?
That's what I quite like about everything that's happening in the scene at the moment, is that it seems to be much more so than I remember it being 10 or 15 years ago.
We've talked about this before, the way boundaries between generic boundaries have broken down a lot in dance music,
exactly.
I think,
well,
of late.
And there's a theory. I think it might be a Simon Reynolds theory, but the most exciting time in any sort of dance underground genre is where no one really knows what to call it, which I think is the case for this
stuff
at the moment.
Are you talking about the hardcore continuum?
The Num.
The Num.
The Num.
The Num.
Okay, I don't want to get into that.
I don't know anything about the Num. But yeah, I think that is a really interesting point. I think as soon as it starts getting codified, it's out of any kind of music, really. As soon as it starts getting codified, you will start getting generic records, whether that's, you know, dubstep or chillwave. You know, there's always that sort of point of confusion. If that Simon Reynolds said that, and Simon Reynolds, I think, has a very, very good point. Right, well, that's about it for today's podcast. Thank you very much for listening. Sam, thank you for coming in.
No problem at all. It was a pleasure.
I hope to see you again.
Yeah, I hope to be invited back.
You certainly will be.
You guys.
Hey, get a room. Rosie, thank you as ever. Always a pleasure, never a chore, darling.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to our producer, Amy. I'm Alexis Petridis, and I'll see you next time, Sensation Seekers.